Good afternoon and welcome to today's Weber Training Teleclass. My name is Nicole Kenny. I'm delighted to be today's moderator, and I have the distinct pleasure of introducing today's faculty, Dr. Sally Bloomfield. Dr. Bloomfield is the chairman of the Scientific Advisory Board for the International Scientific Forum on Home Hygiene and is also a visiting professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Dr. Bloomfield's work focuses on raising awareness of the importance of home hygiene in preventing the transmission of infectious disease and developing and promoting home hygiene practice based on sound scientific principles. She has published over 100 papers on the subject of home hygiene and the role of antimicrobial agents. Currently, Dr. Bloomfield is working to develop the understanding of hygiene issues, such as hygiene hypothesis and antimicrobial resistance. Dr. Bloomfield's seminar today is titled, Are We Too Clean for Our Own Good? The Hygiene Hypothesis and Its Implications for Hygiene, Lifestyles, and Public Health. Dr. Bloomfield, take it away.
Well, hi. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. As Nicole has said, I've chosen the title, Are We Too Clean for Our Own Good? Because what I'd like to try and talk about is the hygiene hypothesis, but I'm going to try and talk about it as a microbiologist rather than an immunologist, and my role as an infection preventionist as to what its implications are for hygiene, lifestyles, and public health. So don't worry, I'm not going to go into some detailed immunology, so those of you who were worrying that might be the case can heave a sigh of relief. So first of all, hygiene hypothesis, what does it mean? Because there's been much debate over the last 20 or so years about the extent to which children should be protected for infectious diseases, and concerns as whether overcleanliness could be linked to this rather rapid rise in allergic diseases in our children, particularly, which we've seen since the 1960s, 1970s. The hypothesis was first proposed in 1989 by David Strachan, who suggested that the rise in allergic diseases was related to the lower incidence of infection. He called it infection, although he didn't really define what he meant by that, in early childhood. And this was based on his assessment of research, which showed two things. First of all, a lot of data suggesting that larger family sizes protects against hay fever, i.e. the more children there are in a family, the more they are exposed to infections from each other. And then secondly, data suggesting that living on a farm with all the animals and so on protects against asthma. And from this, and I believe it's because he was working at the London School of Hygiene at the time, he hit on the idea of calling it the hygiene hypothesis, which now seems rather unfortunate in view of what has transpired. And from this, we have come to the notion that we've become far too clean for our own good. And despite everything that's happening now, we seem to want to continue to repeat this mantra and as if it's just a given truth, and we know now that that's not the case. So just quickly, the aims and objectives of this class. First of all, as I said, understanding the hygiene hypothesis, how our understanding is now developing. Secondly, looking at the factors which might have contributed to the loss of the microbial exposure required for immune regulation, because only if we understand those can we begin to consider what measures we might use to reverse the trends. And then last of all, I want to look at to consider the implications of our new understanding for hygiene practice, for our lifestyles, and for public health. This work really stems from the opportunity we had in 2012 to write a report on the hygiene hypothesis, bringing together all of the data, and it turned out to be a very large report, and because of that, we prepared a summary of the findings and the conclusions. Now, both the report and the summary you can find on the IFH website, and the summary is also available in hard copy. Should you wish for a copy, then please do contact us, and we're happy to send you some copies. So how has our understanding of the hygiene hypothesis developed since that first proposal in 1989 by David Strachan? Because although the role of microbial exposure in immune regulation is now pretty widely accepted, there are two key major developments we must talk about first. First of all, what we now realize is that the concept doesn't just apply to allergies and asthma and hay fever and food allergies and so forth. It applies to a whole range of chronic inflammatory diseases, including the autoimmune diseases such as type 1 diabetes, multiple sclerosis. It applies to inflammatory bowel disease. It applies to some types of depression and cancers. And there are various other things that are being proposed. And you can see from the graph on the right-hand side how the incidence of some of these diseases, both asthma and various types of autoimmune disease, such as multiple sclerosis and type 1 diabetes, have increased the pace since the 1950s up to the year 2000. The second thing that we need to be aware of is that although the epidemiological studies since 1989 have continued to confirm the protective effect of large family size, farm living, the evidence for protective effect of specific infections, exposure to infections, as Strachan first proposed, things like chickenpox and measles and so forth, is much weaker than previously thought. I.e., it fails to confirm this link to infections. It no longer supports this idea that children who have more colds and coughs and are less likely to develop allergies. And, of course, this is very good news for us as infection preventionists because it tells us that allergies and other chronic inflammatory diseases are not the price we're going to have to pay for protection against infectious diseases. And, of course, that's very good news. So building on these various findings and publications, the data that's accumulated since 1989, a number of refinements of the hygiene hypothesis have been proposed. The basic principle still applies, but a number of refinements have now been proposed, which give a much more plausible explanation of the link of microbial exposure to these inflammatory diseases. And it was in 2003 that Professor Graham Rook, first proposed his hypothesis called the old friends hypothesis, although I've seen it in a number of other, being given a number of other names, such as the microbe depletion hypothesis and so on. But let's stick to the old friends hypothesis. What Graham Rook proposed is that the microbial exposures that we need for our immune systems are not infectious diseases, because these have evolved relatively recent in historic terms, i.e. over the last 10,000 years. And he's called these the crowd infections to distinguish them. What he is proposing now is that the microbes that we need are the microbes which we co-evolved with back in hunter-gatherer times, in Paleolithic times, when the human immune system was developing in close contact with the rich range of microorganisms that were around at that time. What he's also saying is that we've actually involved dependency on this microbial exposure, i.e. in the same way as at one time we were able to synthesize vitamin C as a necessary metabolite, because it became plentiful in our diet, we lost this ability. And in the same way, he's proposing that our immune systems have now become so dependent on these old friends' exposures that we cannot actually function properly without them. Now, Rook has hypothesized that the immune system has evolved to require input from at least three sources, which, as already said, he collectively calls our old friends. And you can see that what these old friends include. First of all, it includes the commensal microbiota, the normal microbiota of the skin, of our guts, of the airway, and all of the mucous membranes. And these are readily transmitted from mothers to small children to amongst family members and on to the close contacts that we develop as we go through our daily lives. The second group are the environmental microbiota, organisms which inhabit animals and the soil and air and plants and so forth, species which inhabit our indoor and our outdoor environments and we come into contact with daily during our lives. Then the third group he's called the old infections. These were infections that could persist in the hunter-gatherer group, things like helminths, salmonella, hepatitis A, Helicobacter pylori. What he argued was that these organisms established chronic infections in these hunter-gatherer groups and ever since, which need to be tolerated by the immune system, because once they're established in the host, efforts by the immune system to eliminate them are futile and merely cause tissue damage. And as we'll see in a minute, what has happened with the first two groups is that we have been seeing diminished exposure and a diminished diversity of exposure. And for the old infections, these, he proposes, have been mostly lost. This is complete contrast to what he refers to as the crowd infections. By contrast, these crowd infections, such as the childhood virus infections and so forth, these evolved later, much later, when urbanization led to large communities. They didn't evolve immunoregulatory roles because they either killed us or they induced solid immunity and could not persist in these hunter-gatherer groups. And, of course, these crowd infections have increased, especially in crowded inner city areas. So let's just quickly have a look at how it works, and this is the only immunology that I'm really going to refer to because I think it's quite important. Put very simply, when it comes to asthma and allergies, we know that our immune system exists in order to react against agents which threaten us, such as dust and pollen. But they interact with the immune system, and once the threat has been eliminated, the reaction shuts off. But the important thing is that without proper immunoregulatory systems, this our immune system may overreact. And this is what is the underlying cause of allergies and other chronic inflammatory diseases. The hygiene hypothesis or the old friends hypothesis, what this proposes is that microbial exposures such as the old friends are a key part of developing and maturing and sustaining the immune regulatory system and preventing it from overreacting. Exactly the same sort of model applies to autoimmune diseases. Our immune system, as we know, recognizes self, but the whole point is that it should not attack our own tissues. But again, if our immune regulatory system isn't functioning properly, the immune system can overreact and start to attack our own tissues, resulting in autoimmune diseases. And again, the hygiene hypothesis, the old friends hypothesis, proposes that microbial exposure is a key part of making sure that the immune regulatory system is working properly. And I think it's so important to just understand this. I mean, understanding the actual molecular mechanisms by which the old friends interact with the immune regulatory system is complex, and we still have only limited understanding of this. But I think it's so important to see this very simple system, because I think it's where a lot of the confusion arises, because we so often hear people talk today about how our immune systems have lacked practice. They become weak and they become flabby because we're not being exposed to pathogens. And you can see the whole point of the exposure of the old friends hypothesis is that it's not about the reaction of antigens or microbes with the immune system. It's about the reaction with the immune regulatory system, which prevents our immune system from overreacting. And that's a key and fundamental difference. As a further refinement of this concept, there is now the proposal that the exposure that we need is not confined to a single species. It can be met by one or more of a diverse range of organisms. And this does mean that if any particular species are missing, then this role can be met by other species. It also seems fairly obvious, or it's now being proposed, that not just our old friends, but diversity and turnover of these microbial species is a requirement rather than stable colonization with one species. And I think Professor Rook puts it rather nicely. He likens our immune system to a computer program. When our immune system, the actual program is there, but it lacks data. So after we are born, the important thing is that we experience microbes and build up the data which allows our immune system to become properly regulated. One of the questions we always ask was, well, we talk a lot about the importance of microbial exposure during early childhood, but do these exposures need to be maintained during adult life? Most of the data we have relates to childhood, and it does seem that they are most important during this time, during pregnancy, during the first days or months of our lives. But although things like natural childbirth and breastfeeding, there is good evidence that these are protective, the data suggests that, for example, that breastfeeding needs to be maintained for a significant period, i.e. breastfeeding for up to 6 months. There is some evidence that ongoing exposure may be important, but again, here the evidence is relatively limited. So I've just included here one example, and that is some studies which show that oral treatment of adults with inflammatory bowel disease or multiple sclerosis, oral treatment with Helminth eggs, can result in an arrestment of symptoms or a significant improvement of symptoms. And the graph on the right just shows you one such study, and you can have a look at the data. I've given you the reference here, which shows that multiple sclerosis patients which were allowed to become infected with Helminth eggs as opposed to those that were not treated, the ones that became infected, you can see there is a significant arrestment of their symptoms, whereas those that were uninfected, their symptoms continued to increase and their health declined. So moving on to the next area to consider, it is, well, why has this happened and why now? Because although allergies and chronic inflammatory diseases did exist prior to the 1800s, we can see from the data that these really are largely diseases of the last 100 to 200 years. And I was very surprised to learn when I was studying this that in fact hay fever was so rare in the late 19th century that a doctor who decided to, he himself was a hay fever sufferer and wanted to do some epidemiological studies about risk factors, he actually struggled to find cases to study. Whereas if you look at Allergy UK's website, it's now estimated that in the UK alone, 10 million of us are suffering from hay fever. So if you look at the accumulated data, and I don't want to look into detail, and I've already alluded to the graph that's on the right-hand side of the slide, it suggests that we have seen increasing levels of these diseases, mostly starting from the late 19th century, but then this very rapid rise from the 1970s onwards. So we have to ask what has changed in the past two centuries to deprive us of this requisite microbial exposure. And of course the obvious answer is it was the sanitary, or sometimes called the hygiene revolution. What we saw over this period was improved water quality, improved sanitation. But if you look at the data, as we did for our report, you can see that this really started quite gradually in the 1800s, and that widespread coverage, toilets, chlorinated drinking water and so forth, wasn't really in place until the middle and on into the late 19th century and into the 20th century. During the latter part of the 19th century, the 1850s onwards, was when we saw environmental cleanup of our cities, reduced exposure to human waste and animal excreta in city streets. And of course, over the whole of these two centuries, we've seen huge alterations in our diet and our foods, different foods with different or less microbial content. So if you look at the data in relation to morbidity and mortality from infectious disease, what we can see here in the graph is that the rapid decline in mortality, and you can see that it followed fast on behind the changes over the latter half of the 19th century. During 19 to 1950, we saw this huge decline in mortality of children, largely due to decline in infectious disease. And I could show you some similar graphs which showed the declines in the rate of cholera and typhoid and TB and diphtheria and so forth and the common childhood infections. And all of these clearly suggest an overall decline in infectious diseases. And so it would be very easy to make the conclusion that this is the cause of the rise in allergies is linked to an overall decline in infectious diseases. But although we saw a decline in mortality and morbidity from these killer infections, we've got to remember that doesn't necessarily mean an overall decline in morbidity altogether from infectious diseases. We can see, if we look at the data, for example, that food poisoning rose quite sharply during the critical period of increase in atopic disorders during the 1970s to the 1990s. We know that respiratory infections remain very common, that there is an estimated 3 to 6 episodes that each child suffers of respiratory infection within the first few years of life. So, although the temporal correlation suggests that these factors are involved, and it seems likely that probably not one but all of these factors are involved, if the old friends hypothesis is correct, it's not for the obvious reason, i.e. it's not because of the need for pathogen exposure. Although these measures are vital for protecting us from infectious disease, what has happened is that they have also inadvertently reduced or altered our exposure to our microbial old friends, which happen to inhabit the same sort of habitat. The other question, which is very obvious to us, is could antibiotics be involved? Because antibiotic usage, if you look at it, shows a good temporal fit. We have seen increasing use of antibiotics since they were first discovered at the end of the 1940s, increasing use from the 1950s onwards, and obviously this correlates pretty well with the steep rise in allergies which occurred from the 1970s onwards. Coupled with this was growing evidence from epidemiological studies that antibiotics may be a factor, particularly excessive antibiotic use during pregnancy and during the neonatal period. And there's good microbiological plausibility for a link to antibiotics. They may alter our interaction with microbes, and most particularly, they may reduce the diversity of the gut microbiota, which the old friends hypothesis suggests is key to development and maturation of the immune regulatory system. So I do think this is an area that is going to need to be monitored very closely. And in terms of our efforts to encourage antibiotic stewardship, it may be another good opportunity to encourage prudent antibiotic prescribing in the event that it may be a risk factor in the development of asthma and allergies. In the next slide, I've just cut and pasted some of the studies, the very recent studies, which indicate a link to antibiotic use for asthma, for inflammatory bowel disease, for allergy to cow's milk, and so on, which you can look at if you have a specific interest. I think I need to just mention vaccines very briefly, because the same question is likely to be asked. Because obviously immunization against tetanus and diphtheria introduced during the 1930s, 1940s, followed by vaccines against several childhood infections. But if you look at the epidemiological studies, they provide no consistent report for a detrimental effect on atopy rates. The other question that we obviously need to ask is Is microbial exposure the only factor? And the answer to this, of course, is no, it isn't. What the evidence suggests is that this increased risk of allergies, other chronic inflammatory disease, this depends on a number of factors. Epidemiological data suggests a link to diet, particularly vitamin D deficiency, a link to pollution, a link to less physical activity, obesity, and so forth. A link to socioeconomic factors and stress. It also indicates a strong link to genetic predisposition as a key risk factor. And it may be that this answers the question, why do we not all of us suffer from these inflammatory diseases? It may be because all of us have suffered this same reduction in exposure to old friends, and it may be that for some of us, this less abundant exposure may be sufficient, but for others, it is not. And where other factors kick in, which are listed here, then it tips us over into these inflammatory diseases. What I've done in these last few slides is just to try and introduce you to the new thinking about the link between microbial exposure and inflammatory disease. But if you would like to know more about it, then I do invite you to have a look at this most recent publication from Graham Rook and his colleagues, which, and I've given you the hyperlink to it if you want to have a look at it. And it starts off by the supposition that hygiene hypothesis is now a misleading misnomer. It's no longer a hypothesis, and it's not about hygiene. And in this review, Rook and his colleagues set out a framework showing how lifestyle and medical changes over the past two centuries have worked together to inadvertently deprive us of key microbial exposures and trigger this epidemic of allergies and other chronic inflammatory diseases. And it ends up with the conclusion as follows. What Rook and his colleagues say is, to tackle this problem, we have to stop talking about it as a consequence of our modern obsession with cleanliness. And I've just added in this slide here because I think it's a very nice summary, and I've taken it from this paper, of how we have seen a progressive loss of immunoregulation by progressive loss of exposure to old friends. You can see, first of all, sanitation, water waste disposal, and so forth, bringing about the loss of old infections. Following on from that, cesarean deliver, antibiotics, diet, and so forth, resulting in disturbed human microbiota. And then on to, as urbanization increases, the loss of contact with animals and green spaces. And then finally, the opposite situation, that urbanization sustaining high exposure to the crowd infections, and the fact that infections circulating in the community continue to exert a heavy toll. And we'll come on to that in a minute. But finally, just back to where we started with this idea of, are we too clean for our own good? Because of all the candidate trends that might explain what's happening, the concept that it's due to being too clean in our own homes really does seem the weakest. The role of home and personal hygiene, if it's a factor at all, is small relative to the other factors. And if you examine the data, as we did for our report, what you can see is that even the cleanest looking home is full of bacteria, of viruses, of fungi, and so forth. The data suggests that routine weekly cleaning, however fastidious it may be, actually has no sustained effect on microbial levels. The idea that we can create a sterile home is quite preposterous. The data shows how microbes are constantly replaced into our homes via dust, via air, the body flora, via our pets, our domestic animals, contaminated foods, and so forth. The key point may be that the microbial contents of our home is now different, but not because of increased cleanliness. It's because our modern urban homes interact with a very different environment compared with the rural homes which we all lived in, or the majority of us lived in, prior to the 1800s and the Industrial Revolution. It's very interesting, the data that suggests that up to the 1950s, in the UK, pretty much 50% of children were infested with pinworm, and that this is now relatively rare. So it suggests that if we were to examine our homes, we would be very unlikely to find these organisms. What about personal hygiene? Well, Strachan, in addition to talking about home cleanliness, also suggested that higher standards of personal cleanliness could be an underlying cause. And again, the temporal correlation is quite good, because if you think about it, our increased desire to bath and shower and shampoo and bath the baby has really happened since the 1950s, when we had ready access to hot water and showers and soap and so forth. But we do know that, of course, bathing and showering removes microbes from the skin, but if we look at it, they really are quite rapidly replaced by multiplication, the ones that are left behind. And in fact, there is no good evidence, despite what we tend to assume, linking frequency of washing and showering and bathing to increased allergy risk. Although I have to say, nobody has actually carried out a good epidemiological study which might indicate whether there is a link or not. So I do think this is an area which we need to monitor and keep an open mind about. So the next thing we need to think about is how we set about reversing the trends in allergies and other chronic inflammatory diseases. Well, various therapeutic approaches are being looked at, as you might expect, but as yet things are pretty much at an early stage. And I do think it's going to depend on a much better understanding of the molecular mechanisms by which the old trends act on the immune regulatory system and how this all works. And it depends largely on identifying target structures in the human immune system. And one has to suspect that there is going to be no single target structure. It's going to be an evolving understanding of what's going on, an evolving understanding of how we might develop therapeutic agents. If you're more interested in that area, I recommend a paper by Parker and Ollerton, recently published, which has a look at this particular aspect in more detail. If I talk to Graham Rook, he would say that he thinks that the better option is to look for probiotic drinks or foods which might be used to introduce the key microbes into our bodies. But as he said, progress requires much better understanding of which are the old friends, which are truly friendly, and which are safe. And I think there's a lot more work to be done to identify which those organisms what might be, and whether certain organisms can act for all types of immune diseases, or whether different organisms are required for different diseases. So progress is occurring, but still at an early stage. The other thing that we can think about, or we need to think about, is could lifestyle changes, changes in our own lives, re-establish our exposure to old friends? For example, could encouraging natural childbirth have an impact? Could we encourage sustained breastfeeding? Should we be encouraging more physical interaction between siblings? And as Graham Rook sets and his colleagues set out in their most recent paper, should we be encouraging more sport and other outdoor activities? Could these have a significant impact? But I do think at the moment it's important to be cautious. Reconnecting with our environment, getting dirty, could contribute, but I think we need a much clearer understanding before these approaches could be very strongly advocated and become part of public health policy. Although that having been said, I am aware that Finland, where some of the work has been carried out to understand the impact of the outdoor environment, in Finland, outdoor activity is being actively promoted as part of public health policy to reverse the trends in asthma and allergies and other chronic inflammatory diseases. So where have we got to? Well, if you look at this problem of reversing the trends in chronic inflammatory diseases, then when I said to Rook, what do you think about this? He said, well, the work is progressing very fast, but it has a long way to go. And I am staggered at the extent of the progress and the change in thinking which has happened even since we wrote our report in 2012. But as far as controlling infectious diseases is concerned, as I said at the outset, it's good news. What the evidence is now telling us very strongly is that allergies and chronic inflammatory diseases are not the price we have to pay for protection against infectious diseases. What I think is that we are at last unlocking chronic inflammatory diseases from a link to hygiene and infectious diseases, and we're beginning to realign it with our growing knowledge of the human and environmental microbiome and its considerable impact and implications for our health and the health of our immune system. So that's good news. Because I think at the same time as our concerns about chronic inflammatory diseases has increased, so also has our concerns about infectious diseases. Infectious diseases circulating in the community still, despite everything, exert a very heavy burden on the health and on our healthcare systems. But of course, what we know is that much of this this infectious disease could be prevented by good hygiene, by better hygiene in our homes and everyday lives, as well as in our healthcare facilities. If we look at it, the hygiene-related diseases, gastrointestinal disease, both food and non-foodborne disease, remains at unacceptable levels. In the UK, a recent community-based study suggests over 17 million cases per annum. One in four of us are likely to have some sort of gastrointestinal disease each year. The estimated true number of norovirus cases in the UK is something of the order of 3 million. And of course, these are mostly non-foodborne. We now have good evidence that good hygiene is important, not just in the prevention of spread of skin and eye infections, but also can play a part in preventing the spread of respiratory infections, most particularly cold infections, but also to an extent, influenza infections. And it would seem to me that more than anything, it's this constant emergence of new infections and new strains which is alerting people in the community to the importance of hygiene and the importance of the ongoing fight against infectious disease through good hygiene. And during 2009, when we had concerns about the influenza pandemic, we remember that good respiratory hygiene was strongly promoted as an important key first step to mitigate spread of infection, whilst other measures such as vaccines could be put in place. I think we also need to be aware of the probability that the infectious disease risk in the community is not decreasing but actually increasing. Social and demographic changes mean that the numbers of people in the community who are at risk and are needing special care to protect them against infection is actually increasing. And we did some calculations a few years ago, and what it suggested is that at least one in five of us in the European, and we did studies, we did some calculations in the US as well, at least one in five, probably more of us in the community belong to an at-risk group at greater risk of infection. Obviously, this includes people who are otherwise healthy, the growing elderly population, the very young, pregnant mums, and so forth. But it also includes those with underlying disease who are trying to live a perfectly normal life, people, for example, who are carrying HIV/AIDS. It also relates to the increasing amount of healthcare which is being delivered at home and in the community as a result of shorter hospital stays, and as a result of home-based treatments in the community, chemotherapy, dialysis, and so on. But what we have to remember, of course, is that much of this healthcare is delivered by family members themselves, and which means that all of us need a good understanding of good hygiene practice, of effective hygiene practice. And we have to remember that for these vulnerable groups, it's not just about hygiene related to the sort of treatment that they are or the condition that they are in. It relates to to food hygiene and respiratory hygiene, which are also important, because none of these people want to end up back in the hospital, and certainly the healthcare system doesn't want them there. Now, although we tend to think in terms about hygiene in terms of infectious disease prevention, I believe that increasingly in the ongoing period, we're going to also have to think of it in terms of its impact on antibiotic resistance. We all know that tackling antibiotic resistance is now a global priority, and that hygiene is now seen as a central strategy to tackling this problem of antibiotic resistance. Prevention through hygiene can act in two ways. I'm sorry, the formatting has slipped slightly here. First of all, because it reduces the need for antibiotic prescribing, which is thought to be one of the key drivers of antibiotic resistance. But secondly, because it has the potential to reduce the silent spread of antibiotic resistant strains such as MRSA, NDM1 strains, and so forth in the community. Because as the silent spread of nasal and gut carriage of these strains in the healthy population increases, this means that the risk of hospital and community infections from these strains increases, because so many of these infections are organisms which come from our own body flora. I didn't include a reference on this slide to the review which IFH prepared, looking at all the data that we found on the increasing prevalence of silent carriage of antibiotic resistant strains in the community. And I've just got one example here to illustrate. A study in the UK community back in 2012 showed over 700 people showed that up to 11% of these people were carrying ESBL strains in their stools. So the question we have to ask is, can we have it both ways? If prevention of infectious disease through good hygiene remains a cornerstone of public health, but if the right kind of microbial exposure needs to be encouraged, how do we set about addressing both issues at the same time? How do we persuade people to develop lifestyles which reconnect with the natural environment whilst at the same time protecting themselves from infectious diseases? Well, I think to a certain extent we can, but I think if we are going to do this, we have got to take two key things on board. Firstly, we've got to try and unravel the misconceptions and the confusion which we currently have about dirt and hygiene and cleanliness and so forth. And secondly, we need to develop a much better approach to hygiene, infectious disease prevention, and what it really means in our everyday lives. So, starting with this need to unravel the confusion, this idea that we become too clean for our own good, I wonder what we really do mean when people say it, when experts say it, when the media say it. What are they really saying? Are they saying we need to encourage children to get dirty, or are we saying, well, we need to relax hygiene standards because children who have more infections are less likely to develop allergies? And I suspect if we pinned people down and actually asked these people who are saying this, they would not actually be able to define what they're meaning. So there is a confusion here, and if we look at the next slide, what I've done here is to bring together some of the headlines that I've collected over the last 20 or so years, and you can see that on one day the consumer reads all of these headlines about being clean making us ill and how being dirty can protect us. And then, having done that, the next day, if we look at the next slide, they are faced with a range of headlines which show us how lack of hygiene can damage our health because it leaves us open to infectious diseases. So I do think it's very confusing for the public, and I do wonder how they actually hold both of these concepts in their mind at the same time. And I've deliberately included in here the headline which occurred about, oh, it's about 10 years ago, when a young girl died from E. coli 0157. And when they did an investigation, the most likely cause they came up with that it was probably due to contaminated sewage on a beach where she was visiting. And this links in very nicely to an incident that happened to me some couple of years ago when I was doing a television interview, a radio interview. And these two women who were talking about the hygiene hypothesis, and they were talking very rationally and very sensibly about, yes, I don't protect my children and I don't wrap them in cotton wool and I encourage them to go out and play and get dirty and I don't worry over them. Until one of them suddenly said, and if we're having a picnic on the beach, I don't bother to get my children to wash their hands. And that came home very clearly to me, that she just didn't see any difference between normal day-to-day cleanliness and the things that she does to, or she gets our children to do, to protect them from infectious diseases. So I think, if you look at the next slide, we're all rather confused. And if we're going to move forward, we really do have to start by trying to unravel this confusion. And if you go on to the next slide, I've just included a couple of other examples because I think they're quite interesting and they do illustrate the sort of problems we face. I think if you took a group of pregnant mums and you said to them, and they wanted to talk about how they might get more dirty in order to protect their new offspring, and if you turned around to them and said, well, actually, one of the things you really could do to help your new baby is to make sure you have a natural childbirth and not a cesarean section, that would be a very good way of getting more dirty, they might be a little bit startled. And then I thought the other was quite interesting in that it suggested that children were three times less likely to suffer from eczema if they had a parent who sucked their dummy before they gave it to the children. And you suddenly think, well, whoa, that sounds a bit dangerous. But if you look at the paper, you actually found that in this study, they detected no more upper respiratory tract infections in the children whose parents sucked on their dummies before they gave it to the child. So I do think it's a bit of a dilemma, but I'm sure there is a lot we can do to improve understanding, because I do think we have to change attitudes and understanding. We need to start to distinguish that cleanliness, absence of dirt and social acceptability and freshness is quite different from our infection prevention practices, that ID avoidance is not just about how clean our homes look, how often we shower and so forth. It's about what we do at the times when it matters to stop the spread of germs. It's about washing our hands at the right times. It's about rigorous food hygiene in the kitchen. It's about good respiratory hygiene when we have coughs and sneezes. It's about following hygiene rules when we are caring for our pets. So I would say that if we want to have it both ways, going back to where I started, what we need to do secondly is to adopt a much more focused approach to hygiene in our homes and our everyday lives. And in order to do this, what IFH has been working on for the last 13 or so years since we've been in existence is to develop what we call a targeted approach to home hygiene. And just to look at it very briefly, what a targeted hygiene is about breaking the chain of infection. What it says is that there are certain key sources of infection in our home: people, contaminated food, domestic animals and so forth, and that potential pathogens are being constantly shed from these sources in our homes and everyday lives and circulating such that if circumstances come together and we come exposed, we can become infected. But that good hygiene is getting people to know what are the critical points where organisms survive and are spread as part of the chain of transmission, and using hygiene measures at these points to prevent the ongoing spread of pathogens. What we did was to try and tease out what are the superhighways for preventing spread of pathogens around the home. And we came to the conclusion these are, firstly, the hands, most obviously. They are hands and food contact surfaces, but they are also cleaning cloths and cleaning equipment. If you look at the data, you'll find that cleaning cloths are wonderful. If we don't use them properly, they're great at spreading germs around our home. It also includes other surfaces in contact with the body, things like baths and hand basins and so forth. It also includes clothing and household linens, although the risk from these surfaces is probably somewhat less than the first three groups. Targeted hygiene also means hygienic cleaning to eliminate pathogens from these critical sites before they can spread further. And it means understanding that visibly clean is not necessarily hygienically clean. If our hands are dirty and we wash our hands, then we know from a visual clue that they are clean and the dirt is gone. But if we are washing our hands in order to make them hygienically clean before we handle food, then it's important that we wash them in a prescribed manner, which is sufficient to make them not just visibly clean, but hygienically clean. What I've done there is to try and talk very briefly about the IFH targeted approach to home hygiene. If you want to know more about this approach, then I've included two references here. If you want the short reference, then you can look at a recent publication in AGIC, where we looked at this risk assessment or targeted approach in relation to the use of antimicrobials in the home. If you want the more detailed study with all the evidence that we use to develop the IFH targeted approach, then you can find it on our website. Before I sort of sum up, I think it's worthwhile just making a mention of targeted hygiene in relation to the key issue of sustainability. Because it's pretty obvious to anybody that preventing infection through hygiene and through vaccination programs and so forth, it's intrinsically a more sustainable approach to containing the burden of infectious disease than treatment. But we also have to think about the sustainability of the hygiene practices which we use. And I believe that this multi-barrier approach with focused interventions, which IFH has developed, provides us with a very good framework for building sustainability into hygiene, because it does a number of things. First of all, it is designed to maximize protection from pathogen exposure risks. It also minimizes the environmental impact by discouraging overuse of cleaning products and the possibility of antibiotic resistance problems due to low-level microbicide exposure. But in relation to what we're talking about here, the hygiene hypothesis, targeted hygiene can also work to restore our exposure to our old friends without at the same time restoring pathogen exposure. Just finally, before I finish, and I'm doing very well for time, I notice, if I can just talk a little bit about the IFH and our communication strategy. The IFH was an organization which was set up in 1997 with the aim to develop and promote an approach to home hygiene based on sound scientific principles. Over the years, we've developed a whole range of communication materials which we communicate through our website and through other channels such as conference presentations, teleclasses, and so forth. And if you go to our website, you will find a whole range of scientific reviews which give the evidence base for the targeted approach for home hygiene and contain the review of the hygiene hypothesis and our look at whether antimicrobial resistance is an issue in relation to the use of antimicrobials in the home and community. It also contains a whole range of guidelines and training materials which we have developed in relation to putting targeted hygiene into practice. And if you're interested, we've just introduced a new web area which looks specifically at this very important area of growing importance, which is infection control, not in healthcare facilities, but in home health care. And as I say, all of these are available to download from our website. If you're interested in our work, do sign up for our IFH news sheet to give you the latest developments on hygiene, home hygiene, and hygiene issues. So finally then, what are the conclusions? Well, I think what I hope I've shown you is that allergies remain a very serious public health problem which needs to be tackled, as also do other chronic inflammatory diseases, inflammatory bowel disease, multiple sclerosis, type 1 diabetes, and so forth. All of these are a huge health problem. But so also are infectious diseases. But of course, many of these are preventable by good hygiene. So I think I'd like to conclude with a couple of quotes, one from Ross Stanwell-Smith and one from myself, because in the report that we produced, Ros Stanwell-Smith concluded by saying the following. She said, using home and personal cleanliness as a scapegoat for the problem that has a much more complicated set of causes is not only justified, it's ill-advised, because what it's doing is diverting effort from finding the true causes and workable solutions which address all of these three health issues. My thought is that in the future, we are going to have to view our microbial world very differently. If I look back to the 1950s, our parents and our grandparents must have heaved a huge sigh of relief. They must have looked at the fact that they now had water and sanitation, clean food, they had vaccines, they had antibiotics, which meant that their children were no longer at high risk of dying of some sort of infectious disease. And we began to say, well, okay, by the end of the century, infectious diseases are going to be a thing of the past. We are human organisms. We can now cut ourselves off from this rather horrible, invisible microbial world. But what we're going to have to do now, in the same way as we have learned to conserve our natural macrobiotic world and find it important, we are going to have to begin to conserve and to begin to interact again with this microbial world as a key part of sustaining our own health, both our nutritional health and so forth, but also key the health of our immune system. So thank you very much for listening, and I pass you back to our chairman.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bloomfield. It was a very informative seminar, and I think for many of us, particularly those with children, you've truly highlighted the importance of how practicing good hygiene every day can improve your health. And I think I'm particularly thankful for growing up on a farm and knowing that I was exposed definitely to lots of microbes that have perhaps done me well as I've grown into being an adult. On behalf of Weber Training, I hope everyone enjoyed today's teleclass. Thank you to our patron sponsors, Virox Technologies, World Health Organization, and the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology. If you have any questions for Dr. Bloomfield, please email your questions directly to Dr. Bloomfield. And I hope that many of us will join us on May 5th, which is World Hand Hygiene Day, for Professor Didier Pettet's seminar on Clean Your Hands, Stop the Spread of Drug-Resistant Germs. Thank you, and have a wonderful afternoon.